Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now, I'm delighted to say we have Dr. John Bloom on the line, Associate Professor at Shippensburg University, Pennsylvania, and author of There You Have It, The Life, Legacy and Legend of Howard Cosell. This week would have marked Howard Cosell's 100th birthday. He passed away back in 1995, widely regarded and considered America's preeminent sports broadcaster of the 20th century. And to quote his New York Times obituary, he entered sports broadcasting in the mid-1950s when the predominant style was unabashed adulation, and he offered a brassy counterpoint that was first ridiculed, then copied until it became the dominant note of sports broadcasting. So let's talk about Howard Cosell, not a straightforward character. John, you're very welcome to the show. Cosell said of himself, arrogant, pompous, obnoxious, vain, cruel, verbose, and a show-off. There's no question I'm all of those things.
Yeah, that really, he had at least very good self-awareness. Those were all terms you could use to describe him. But in my book, I also write about he's a very complex character, too. Somebody who didn't fit easy categorization. And for that reason, I find it really unique and great accident that he ended up becoming such a top American celebrity. He isn't like most American celebrities that you would think of.
I mentioned that New York Times obituary, which talked about the kind of unabashed adulation, which was generally the tone of the day. But Cosell came along and was critical of players. And his catchphrase was, I mean, he often just said, I'm just telling it like I see it. So this was a new thing.
Tell it like it is.
I watched a documentary on him this morning, and, you know, at the kind of height of his broadcasting career, obviously he was very associated with boxing, and we'll talk about that, and he did baseball, but Monday Night Football was a huge part of his career, and this started kind of 1970 territory. He did it for 15 years. I saw footage of people shooting televisions with him on it. He was, I think, simultaneously the most hated and most loved sports broadcaster in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think Monday Night Football really highlighted that with him. Before Monday Night Football, he was seen as more of a kind of sports intellectual in a way, you know. So he would do boxing broadcasts quite a bit, really was very much involved in keeping Muhammad Ali's career alive during the years when he was banned from boxing and going through the courts because he had objected to the draft.
Yeah.
And then during the Vietnam War, and then 1970 comes on to Monday Night Football. And initially Monday Night Football, initiated a couple of new things for American football broadcasting. One of them had three people in the booth. So before that, you only had two people in the booth. One person was a professional play-by-play announcer, as they called him. And then the other would have been typically a former football player of some kind. And they tended to treat the game in a very humorless kind of methodical fashion. And Monday Night Football turned it into an event, you know, something that was very much about entertainment.
Yeah.
And Cosell was put in the booth as the third man. And the play-by-play announcer is a guy named Keith Jackson. And Jackson and Cosell had a lot of admiration and respect for one another. And then the third guy was a former quarterback from Texas who had a wicked sense of humor named Don Meredith, or as Cosell called him, Dandy Don.
Yeah.
And for the first year, they kind of got along all right. But Meredith became really famous because he would just take Cosell down all the time. And their dynamic became core to the entertainment value of Monday Night Football, but it also, over the years, really grated on Cosell. And especially the next year, when the play-by-play announcer was replaced, instead of having Keith Jackson, he brought in another former football player named Frank Gifford.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cosell in Gifford saw everything he hated about what he called jock culture. He's, you know, thought Gifford was just a good-looking, good-sounding sort of former player and had very little respect for him.
Yeah.
And from really then on, you know, that play between the three of them was very entertaining, but it really wore down Cosell over the years. By the end of his career, he was very bitter.
Yeah, a fascinating dynamic. And Monday Night Football became a huge success. So from 1970 to 85, Cassell was there. Even in his book, I Never Played the Game, which he brought out towards the end of his career, Cassell, I mean, he pretty much hammers Gifford and Meredith, doesn't think they're very good. So this is not Swiss Family Robinson. This is a kind of bitter dynamic they're stuck in, and they're travelling around the country together to go to these games, and they don't get on terribly well, and yet everybody kind of loves it. That's the deal. How critical was Cassell at his worst? Because I mentioned that kind of tone of adulation. So what was he saying that outraged people?
Well, the core of his arguments was always that, as he put it, sports media and sports institutions were in an unholy alliance. So in other words, if you look at an American television network that's broadcasting the NFL, they would have paid the NFL, you know, at this point, billions of dollars to broadcast them. And then, so they're a client. And then at the same time, they're supposedly, as journalists, covering a sporting event. And so that was sort of the core of his critique, that, you know, they were not objective. They were actually, as he called them, shills.
Yeah.
And, you know, a shill is somebody who acts as if they're sincerely interested in a particular issue that they're presenting, but they're really selling something. Mm. And that was sort of his main critique and main argument. And I think that probably what got him in most trouble was when he took that argument and made it very personal. So when he went after Frank Gifford and went after Don Meredith in books like I Never Played the Game, that really hurt him. And of course, what probably ended his career, they were probably looking for an excuse to fire him, but what ended his career is he made a kind of racist comment during a game. He called, I'm forgetting his name, African-American wide receiver for the Washington NFL team during a game, Monday Night Football game. He said, "That little monkey really can run." People defended Cosell over that because he earlier called a white running back, Mike Appleby, a little monkey as well. But I think, you know, anytime you use that phrase and you're referring to somebody who's African-American, you should know better. And he certainly should have known better. And he was rightly criticized for that. Mm. But instead of admitting that he said this and just apologizing for it, he initially simply denied that he ever said it, which was probably the worst thing to do.
Yeah, because there is footage of him using that phrase with other players, white players, down the years. In 1972, he certainly used it, and his family say that's just how he referred. That was a turn of phrase that he had sometimes. And it seemed, I mean, his relationship with Ali, and I know he worked with Arthur Ashe as well. I mean, Cassell could not be described as racist, I don't think.
No, absolutely not. But at the time that nobody else was referring to Muhammad Ali by the name he had chosen, and they were calling him by the name he was given at birth, Cassius Clay. Howard Cosell was calling him by Muhammad Ali. But not only that, defending his decision to not go and fight in the Vietnam War. Mm. What Cosell really was, you know, a defender of Ali's right to make that decision, and respected the right to make that decision. I don't know for sure that he thought the decision itself was good or not. Mm-hmm. Cosell was certainly critical of the Vietnam War, but he also, you know, was somebody who, you know, was in the military during World War II and felt that you should do your duty. So, you know, it's hard to say how he actually came down, but he always defended Ali on that ground. He also was the only person to interview Tommy Smith after the 1968 Olympic protest, mm-hmm. when Tommy Smith gave his one-fisted protest with John Carlos, and defended Tommy Smith and gave a just very sharp critique of the U.S. Olympic Committee and the International Olympic Committee for condemning Tommy Smith and John Carlos for their protest, which just if you ever get a chance to see that, it just is an amazing commentary. And he defended other people like Kirk Flood, who was African-American baseball player who refused to be traded from the St. Louis Cardinals to the Philadelphia Phillies, who were a team that had a very reputation for a very racist fan base. And so he defended that as well. So he was often, you know, someone who defended African-American athletes, mm-hmm. and was in the forefront of thought in terms of the civil rights movement. The downside of it is that he sometimes felt like African-American athletes owed him something because of that. So when he said the little monkey comment, instead of simply saying, you know, I'm sorry, he was angry at African-American athletes for not coming to his defense.
You mentioned Ali there. That was one of the defining relationships he had right across his career. They had a genuine rapport. Here's just a brief sample of Cassell and Ali in action.
Whom would you like to fight and where and when?
I'd like to fight whoever you think's the best.
I'm not sure that there's anybody left, really, for you to fight.
You.
That may come about someday. Thank you for coming
on. Stay in shape.
Are you taking Zora Foley too lightly?
Why would you say that?
Because every indication has been that you're confident that you can beat Zora.
I'm confident I can whip all of them. This ain't nothing new. My image is being confident. What you trying to make it look like something new for? I'm always confident I can whip all of them.
You're being extremely truculent.
Whatever truculent mean, if that's good, I'm that.
Wait, let's get the facts straight. I made you.
You made me.
Nobody knew you.
You made me.
I took a poor little kid from Louisville and
made me.
Let's put it on the table.
About anybody who didn't watch football didn't know you. Come on, it gets back with the interview now.
Number two.
You always said, Muhammad, you're not the man you were 10 years ago, right?
Right.
Well, I'm going to ask your wife, are you the man you was last year?
You'll get a quick answer than that.
He was brilliant. I mean, we should say that about Cassell.
Yeah.
You don't just have a career this long and do all the huge events in different sports without being brilliant and having a great inflection and delivery. And actually, I saw him in a robust interview with the Miami broadcaster in this documentary I was watching this morning, where Cassell obviously didn't like the line of questioning. And he said to this Miami reporter, well, I have a better grasp of the English language than you. I have better nuance. I have better inflection, a better use of my voice. If you were in my league, you'd be in New York. You know, so there is an arrogance there. And I just have, these are not particularly standout clips. They're really not. But just to give people a sense of his style at times, we'll play the more iconic moments in a moment. But he could throw in sentences like these just randomly and all the time. So here he is at one point talking about a boxing fight followed by a football game. And it's just to give people who didn't hear him at the more mundane moments, to give them a flavor of his style.
Because he doesn't really have confidence in his own stamina, despite his protestations to the contrary.
Where Shula's a genius is in his coordination of these people, a proper delegation of authority, and yet the close cohesion that he produces in and between the respective units.
So that's a mark above the average.
You know, there's a story I heard from one of the people I interviewed that he had a radio thing that went on. It was like a 90-second radio show that went on every day called Howard Cosell Speaking of Sports and Howard Cosell Speaking of Everything. Hmm. And he was interested in sort of, you know, more than sports. He always was interested in other things going on culturally. So he would sit down and gather his staff in his office, say, what's going on right now? You know, what movies are out? What shows are on Broadway? What are the big news items? And they would talk about things. And then he'd sort of write down a couple notes and then go in without his notes to the recording studio and in 90 seconds exactly come up with a commentary. So being on radio yourself, I mean, I'm sure you could admire, you know, somebody with that kind of mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, his vocabulary was something that was often mocked, though, by a lot of fans, you know, sort of in an anti-intellectual way. But he was a, you know, absolutely brilliant person with an amazing memory. And you know, you said that the guy from Miami didn't like the questioning line of questioning, and he said, I've got this great mind and so forth. And, you know, part of that, once again, you know, I make a big deal about his Jewish identity growing up in Brooklyn, you know, among a working class family that was always, you know, and at that time in the United States, if you're Jewish living in Brooklyn, you're outside of America. You're not really considered to be an American. And you know, he was always kind of fighting his way in and fighting for ways to people, for people to take him seriously.
I saw a few people make the point that he was both insecure and had an absolutely massive ego. And Woody Allen was talking about him. And he said, as time went on, he said, Howard isn't a person, he's a cartoon. And you know, we did see Cassell take on entertainment chat shows, which didn't do brilliantly well. But, you know, he did see himself as larger than life. And there probably was a point in late 70s, early 80s, where he was about as famous as anybody in American life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you could, you know, I think that right now, if I went around and mentioned the top sportscasters to, 20 people on the streets, maybe, half of them would recognize who they were. Howard Cosell, everybody knew who they were, who he was. Every school kid had a, Howard Cosell imitation they could do on the playground. I mean, he was probably the most recognized person in the country. So he transcended really just being a sportscaster.
Yeah, but Insecure as well. I mean, he had a terrible relationship with the print press. He called them hacks, $10,000 a year hacks, and they would criticize him, and it was a war across much of his career. I did want to ask you about his personal life. So, his vices. He certainly loved a cigar, and that seemed to be ubiquitous. He kind of had a cigar at all times. He was allegedly drunk on air on one occasion, though he says it was medication, but certainly took a few drinks at times. Right. As for, womanizing or that, it seems he was, notably devoted to his wife.
Right. He was. But then he probably, I would say that if he were around now in the Me Too movement, that he would probably have a lot of women that would be coming forward saying, he created a very hostile work environment for them. So, there's never any indication he ever, went further than, sexually suggestive jokes or stories or, making somebody uncomfortable. But at the same time, a lot of women who worked for him would have experienced that.
Right. Okay. And his relationship with his wife?
He was totally devoted to his wife, and that, I had never interviewed, read anything that suggested anything other than that. That, in fact, many people said the only person in the world who had any sort of power over Howard Cosell was his wife, Emmy. So they had a long marriage, and they were very different in background from one another. She came from a Protestant, Republican family outside of Philadelphia from Westchester, Pennsylvania. And, he came from the other side of the tracks. And but they were totally devoted to one another and had a very happy family. And, his daughters and grandchildren are still devoted to him. Mm. So he had a very, very strong, family, a home on Long Island on the water. That was sort of a key part of their lives as well.
To finish up, there's a certain few iconic moments you kind of have to touch on if you're talking about Cosell. So here's 1974, just to add a certain symmetry and layer to ultimately announcing John Lennon's death. But 1974, Monday Night Football, and I guess this was the kind of innovative stuff they were doing. It was December 1974, Washington against Los Angeles Rams, and they cut away for a short break, and Cosell is there with John Lennon.
Now I've got a most familiar figure and face for all of you across the country here with me now, of the original Beatles, Mr. John Lennon.
Hello.
John, nice to see you, John.
Nice
want to
be
move
here.
That up just a little closer.
How are you?
What's been your view of this American professional football scene?
It's an amazing event and sight. It makes rock concerts look like tea parties. But I must say, the first thing I heard when I got in was I'm playing a Beatles tune yesterday, which cheered me up no end. I've been trying to follow the game, but I couldn't understand why half the team was off and half the team was on.
Well, we can't explain that to you now, but what's your general impression of the game as compared with A, rugby, and B, soccer, football?
It's nothing like soccer, but I can see a very close relationship to rugby football, which has the same shape ball and they move 15 yards down the line at a time. But I can see the game here has changed completely from that. But it's very similar in its aspects. The goals are the same. They have points the same. They have to get a touchdown the same. But they don't have the scrum here.
Will the Beatles ever reunite?
You never know. You never know. I mean, it's always in the wind. If it looked like this, it might be worth doing, right?
You did just spend the weekend with Ringo.
Yeah, and I promised him I'd mention his album Out Now, and I said I wouldn't mention my own, which is out now, too. Forget it.
Thank you very much,
John. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Howard.
Well, maybe we'll get to talk to you later in the show.
Well, you can see why Monday Night Football was must-watch TV when you have moments like that popping up. And that intersection of culture and sport, which you mentioned. So Cosell clearly understood the appeal of that. And then December 1980, Monday Night Football, again, the symmetry of it. Miami Dolphins against New England Patriots.
We have to say it. Remember, this is just a football game, no matter who wins or loses. An unspeakable tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon, outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous perhaps of all of the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival. Hard to go back to the game after that news flash, which in duty bound we had to take. Frank?
Indeed it is.
I mean, that is incredibly well handled, John. I mean, that is some of his skill to the fore there. He's authoritative. He's delivering the news. There's a touch of drama about it, as there was about everything Cassell did, and the right amount of sensitivity as well.
Yeah, yeah, and very, you know, impromptu. There's a great little clip that was circulating a while back on the internet of right before he said that, or in a commercial break, and Frank Gifford said, "I don't know if I can do this," and Cosell said, "I'll step in, you know, I'll make the announcement." So, he had kind of a natural skill at that.
Mm. One last one then on the boxing front. One of his more famous broadcasts is the Frazier fight. I mean, again, this is kind of a celebrated clip. So it's Frazier Foreman, and he had in advance very much tipped Foreman to take the title off Frazier. So here he is calling that.
We'll find out tonight just how good George Foreman is in punching and in taking a punch. I think he hurt Joe Frazier. I think Joe is hurt. Angie Dundee, Ali's trainer, right next to me, is saying it. You may hear him. Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier! The heavyweight champion is taking the mandatory eight count, and Foreman is as poised as can be in a neutral corner.
Perfect.
Boy, those
again.
Were, you know, very dramatic days for heavyweight boxing.
Sure.
And they just kind of, today, obviously, it's nothing like that. And he was just kind of the voice of it, you know, and that's a fight Ali wasn't even involved in. But then it set up this drama of Foreman, Ali and what was then Zaire, today it's Congo. And then his rematches with Frazier as well. So I think you almost can't separate the drama of boxing from the voice of Cosell at that time.
Yeah. And in 1982, Larry Holmes fought Randall Tex Cobb, and Cosell called that fight. He was horrified over the brutality of it. He felt it was one-sided and the fight should have been stopped. And this was, I think, a fortnight after Ray Mancini had killed a man in the ring. And that was him done with boxing. He left boxing. And that's quite... you have to say it's quite a principled stance. I saw somebody this morning on that documentary I was watching almost... pour some suspicion over that and say, well, Cosell was just looking for a reason to get out and this suited him.
I don't know. I mean, he did go on and do Olympic boxing after that. He did
right,
the
okay.
19 Olympics. Part of the reason why he was looking for a reason to get out of prize fighting might have been the corruption that he saw within it. I mean, it's funny. I just was reading, going back and reading some of my old stuff and my old sources, and the latest book he wrote was called What's Wrong with Sports. And in that section, I read the section where he actually has this kind of very mocking passage on Donald Trump. And he connects Trump to the, you know, corruption of boxing at the time, because Trump's casinos would try to attract boxing matches and that sort of thing. So I think he felt the boxing world was a pretty corrupt world. And that might have been why he wanted to get out of it.
Well,
too.
He's probably not wrong. That things don't end brilliantly, as you suspect, for Cosell and ABC, and it can be abrupt. And he certainly fell out with lots of people. The title of that book you mentioned towards the end of his life suggests that he fell out of love with sport as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, it doesn't express any sentiments that he hadn't expressed throughout his career. There's a recording of him in 1968 saying exactly the same thing as he says in his book, but it's much more detailed and bitter, and he really gets into the weeds in a way that he never had before, and you can tell he was very much embittered by probably the experience of losing his job at ABC and losing relevance as a sports broadcaster as well. And he also wrote that book right around the time that his wife Emmy died, and that really kind of took the air out of him.
Yeah. Well, it must have been dreadful for him, a man with that ego, to go from the most important voice, not just in one sport, but in sport, to losing his job and irrelevance. And a newer generation is not really caring too much what he had to say.
No, absolutely. And in fact, by the time he died, like, I think a lot of people were sort of asking, oh, I didn't realize he was alive anymore. I mean, it would have been that long since he really had been relevant, been on the air. He did have one last project that he did with ABC called Sports Beat, which was like a sports news magazine. Mm. And it was, from all accounts, really a well-done investigation into sports. And they did investigations into all sorts of things, like the kind of ways that in the United States, one of the things that happens a lot is cities will be kind of held hostage by sports teams that want to build new stadiums, and they'll get public funding to build the stadiums. And they did, you know, an investigative piece on that and a number of other things. So he still maintained, you know, sort of, you know, a kind of commitment to some of the ethical aspects of sports broadcasting.
So a final question, because I know you have to run. His legacy is clear. I mean, the New York Times talked about him as the preeminent sports broadcaster of the 20th century, and his fame certainly suggests that. I haven't spent as much time thinking or watching Howard Cosell as you, given that you've written the book on him. I'm unsure how I feel about him. I respect the brilliance because it's just so obvious, but certainly the cruelty and the ego, I'm less sure about. I don't know how I feel about Howard Cosell. To put it in simple terms, after studying him for so long and listening to everybody tell you about him, do you like him?
I think that I like him in the sense that you like kind of a difficult person sometimes, but I very much understand people who wouldn't like him. You know, when he was complicated. You know, back in the 1950s, when he was ambitious and trying to get into the business, during the Red Scare here, he really threw some people under the bus, you know. So, you know, and as much as that's the type of thing he would have been very critical of somebody else for doing. Mm. You know, he'd been very critical of somebody else for saying the little monkey comment and not owning up to it. Mm. So there was a lot about him not to like. Mm. But I think sometimes people who are very conflicted and contradictory are also very, very interesting people too. And so I guess I would say that maybe I somewhat like Howard Cosell, but I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have liked me very much.
Well, we'll leave it there. People can read your book if they want to check it out. Dr. John Bloom, there you have it, The Life, Legacy and Legend of Howard Cosell, who would have been 100 this week. Thanks very much, John.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.